Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I am with Lionel Burney today, fresh from the London Bike Show.
It was in Birmingham.
British Bike
it
Show.
It was in Birmingham, Richard.
And Daniel Freeburg.
Hello.
Lionel, where are we? Are we in Birmingham?
No, we are in London, in our new favourite haunt, the South Bank Centre.
We're south of the river, so it doesn't really count, does it, as London?
No, even. It doesn't. I mean,
the deep south.
Yeah, it's a bit grey out as well. Autumn is definitely
always
upon
is
us.
In South London. Always grey in
it
South
is.
London.
The sun is shining on the north side of the river.
Yes, it is. In fact, that's not a lie.
It's splitting the sky. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to go back over the worlds a little bit, a little review of the World Championships. Look ahead to the Tour of Lombardy. We're going to discuss the ongoing case of Jonathan Tiernan Locke. We are going to look ahead to the London Bicycle Film Festival. We've got an interview with Laura Fletcher, the director of that. And then finally, we're going to talk about Daniel Freeb's new book, Mountain Higher.
The Cycling Podcast with HumansInvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So, the World Championships, we talked about that on Sunday, Daniel, but Lionel, you were in Birmingham, you say, and did you see much of the World Championships?
I did. I saw the men's time trial, I saw the women's road race for a couple of hours on Saturday afternoon, and I saw about the last hour, I suppose, of the men's road race. So I missed all the torrential rain.
You missed the British team as well.
I missed the British team, yeah. I was at the cycle show in Birmingham, the trade show.
We've established that.
Yeah. We had Sean Kelly signing copies of his book on our cycling anthology stand.
That's Hunger, published by Peloton Publishing.
It is, yeah. And Sean was quite typically cutting about the performance of the British and the Irish teams. He said, basically, he said they were feckin' soft. Out of 100 kilometres.
Kelly wouldn't have packed it, would he?
Kelly wouldn't have packed that race, no. And to give him some, even more credit for, he often does pick winners. If you listen to his commentary on Eurosport, he's very good. And on the previous day, we had a little talk on the stage at the cycle show, and he tipped Joaquin Rodriguez for the victory. I kind of thought, I'm not sure Rodriguez will necessarily be there at finish because of this thing of, if it's a sprint from a small group on the flat, I couldn't see him winning it. And obviously I was right in that.
You were right.
But I hadn't really sort of factored him in as a potential winner, I must admit.
It was interesting, we touched on at the weekend, Rich, with the mighty Chiro. This idea that the British team, and British very successful British teams of the last few years, ride to quite a rigid plan, and that has been part of their success, that they are single-minded. And particularly in Copenhagen, their success was founded on that single-mindedness. But in a kind of an old-fashioned race like Sunday's, where there was a lot of improvisation because, external factors change the race so much, crashes change the race so much, whether they are yet able to deal with those different permutations. And this might also explain why Team Sky have been so poor in the classics so far, when you can never, ever predict exactly what is going to happen.
Interesting, isn't it? Because Froome, it was explained that he pulled out because he turned around and he didn't have any teammates there, and clearly the plan stated that there would be teammates for support. And he's somebody who, although he's part of Team Sky and the Great Britain team, it is something of a maverick at times. He does... appear to be able to improvise.
As we saw in the Pyrenees in the Tour, when he was left on his own and rode all day. But as Daniel says, a Tour stage, even a very hard one, is much more controlled than a World Championship.
I also suspect his form was much better than... Yeah. I mean, this is another thing, but Froome is very skinny. Mm. Yeah. Would he feel the cold more? Does that wash, so to speak? I don't imagine he grew up. I mean, growing up in Kenya, it's possible that he's
could he do it on a rainy, wet, windy Wednesday evening in Stoke? Is what you're trying to say?
I thought Rod Ellingworth's comments afterwards were quite telling. He was clearly pretty angry about how the team had performed, and I think this thing about weather is a is a bit of a red herring. And you know, the cliche in football is, can they do it on a rainy Tuesday night in Stockport? And I don't think that really does wash. You know, it is the same.
You can tell everybody. Lionel supports a low division team. He said Stockport. I said Stoke.
I was going to say it for next.
So, but Rod said afterwards that they weren't committed enough to what the plan was, and I think that was fairly obvious to see. But could they have improvised the plan once bodies started falling around them? Once Froome had lost Thomas and Stannard, I think, you know, he would have really struggled to get through to the final phase of the race. And then, had he even done that, is he tactically sharp enough to win a single day race like that, where, as we saw, there were so many factors at play in that last hour, and particularly when the final move went away, you know, Nibali was kind of hamstrung because on home roads, everybody was looking to him to do all of that work to bring it back. Valverde was sitting there like a passenger. You know, the complexities of having two Movistar riders and two Spaniards in that last group, you know, all of that kind of overlap. I'm not convinced that Sky's riders necessarily have that same kind of instinct to read the point at the end of a race. Apart from Muran, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you look, Lionel, I mean, perhaps my memory is a bit selective here, but you look at occasions when Sky, and I don't want to bracket Team GB and Sky together too much because they are different entities, but you know, you look at times when Sky have kind of had difficulties or fallen to pieces. You know, I think of the stage in Porrentruy in the Tour de France last year, which was a stage which on paper looked like it was going to go one way, went a completely different way, and Sky, they didn't fall apart, but they certainly struggled. I remember the stage of Tirreno Adriatico this year with Chris Froome, a very, very difficult route. The route proved to be more difficult than everyone expected. The weather was awful, and again, they kind of folded. And at the Tour de France this year, when in the Pyrenees, Froome weathered the storm absolutely brilliantly that day, but on the stage to Bagnères de Bigorre, when attacks went from the gun, again, no one expected it. Again, they didn't really know how to deal with it.
Crosswind stage as well, you know, exactly. Again, an unpredictable factor, an unpredictable element. I think as well in one day races, I mean, in stage races, they have their blueprint, and you know, that build started to become established at the start of 2012 with Paris-Nice and Tour de Romandie, and all, and by the time they got to the Tour, they kind of had a lot of faith in that blueprint. There are no precedents in one-day racing for them, and maybe it just needs to, maybe a couple of these one-day races need to go well in order to gain the experience and the knowledge that you can do it. I think it's still a great unknown for a lot of their riders.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to criticise Geraint Thomas for the classics, you know, Paris-Roubaix and the Tour of Flanders this year, you know, he was on the deck at, it basically crashed at exactly the wrong moment in both races. And, you know, people who are very adept at classics races will tell you that you kind of, it's a bit of a cliche, but you make your own luck by looking after your positioning. You know, people always say, oh, ride at the front, ride at the front. But there are very valid reasons to do that, to be in the first two or three. And when you watch Cancellara, Boonen, the real specialists at those kind of races, you kind of see them but don't see them sort of thing. They're there, but they're not right in the pointy end. But they're not sort of half a dozen or a dozen riders back. And I think that skill is something that you learn presumably through sort of confidence. And as you say, if it goes right once, then they can replicate that. But at the moment, they haven't got that ability to sort of freelance particularly well.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
All right, fellas, that's enough of the worlds. Let's look ahead. Giro di Lombardia.
Il Lombardia now. It's been excitingly rebranded.
Ah, okay.
Do you know why this is? It's apparently because the RCS Sport, which we've had some fairly alarming news about today, and we'll go on to later, I'm sure. And they are keen to keep the Giro, so which means Tour in Italian. They're keen to keep that synonymous with only one race, and that's the Giro d'Italia. So they've rebranded Lombardy, renamed it Il Lombardia, which we will ignore, I think.
Yeah,
and just call it
the Tour of Lombardy. What are your predictions for the race? What are your thoughts about the race? Always an enjoyable one.
What have they done with the route this year, Daniel? Because it does change a bit year to year, or
so
every so often.
The route this year, if I'm not mistaken, is the same as last year. So we've got the very notable climbs. Colle Brianza is a historic climb of the Tour of Lombardy that comes very early, not particularly hard. And got the Muro di Sormano, which is the infamous 2 kilometre long, I think, about 14% average, incredibly difficult, controversially so. I think last year Bjarne Riis said it was a circus and various other riders were unhappy about its inclusion. Then we got the Colma di Sormano, it's not too hard, then the Ghisallo, and then the last climb is Villa Vergano, again very, very steep. So they've messed around with the route endlessly over the years. I'm not a huge fan of, you know, Muro di Sormano is fantastic to include in the race, but you know, it's an awfully long way from the finish this time. When it was included in the 60s, they said it was too close to the finish, because the finish then on both occasions, I think, was in Como, and it kind of always decided the outcome of the race. But, it feels a bit like a gimmick to have it so early on in the race anyway.
It's a beautiful-looking race, though, isn't it? If the weather is not... we've had some pretty bad weather in the last few years, but it's nicknamed the... Is the nickname in Italian the same as we call it, the race of the falling leaves?
Yeah.
So, obviously, autumnal colours. Lombardy is a beautiful part of Italy, isn't it? And I think, for me, that's the thing I look forward to most, is the roads always look really smooth. It looks like a beautiful place to ride your bike. And the only thing I think about it is that motivation levels among the riders are starting to wane. And
they really vary enormously, don't they?
Really, there's, you could probably pick the riders who are at the sharp end of the world will be the favourites. And people like Diego Ulissi, who won the one-day race the other day.
Rui Costa in his world championship attire, I'm sure, will be up for it.
Yeah, to try to counteract that, they have moved it forward. Again, quite controversially so. There is a school of thought that it should be the last race of the season, or the last very big race of the season. But RCS were very aware that riders were, motivation levels were low, and they want to attract as many good riders as possible. I mean, I noticed the field, was it yesterday? Milan Turin was extremely good. No one paid much attention to the race, but Rodriguez, Nibali, Ulissi, and Valverde. So, there are a lot of riders, good riders, who will contend in Lombardy, who are in very good form at the moment, and seems to be still very motivated.
Yeah, I mean, the peloton is kind of split between riders who can't wait for the season to end and those who wish it wasn't ending because they've hit form for whatever reason. Whether the guys who've come out of the Vuelta in good shape would probably want some big races. So I noticed Dan Martin is riding it, and he was talking up his chances. He had a very disappointing World Championships. It's a race that it certainly suits a rider of his abilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced that Dan Martin will win Lombardy between now and the end of his career, whether it's this year or not.
Yeah, Dan Martin pulled out of the Vuelta and then rode the Tour of Britain and was in pretty good shape there. He misjudged the finish on Hay Tour, but he was aggressive on all the climbs. The World Championships, I think if it hadn't been, terrible weather, half the field out before the halfway mark almost, wasn't it? That was more of a lottery than a bike race in the first phase. If the weather's good in Lombardy, he could and should be up there.
Okay, my tip is Rigoberto Urán for Il Lombardia. I think he will win Il Lombardia. Made for him, and he's obviously in good form.
Yeah.
If he doesn't misjudge a corner that he's already been round 9 times, then he should be all right.
To be fair, he hit the white line, didn't he?
Yeah, he hit the white line, yeah.
I've leant over just a bit much.
Yeah, but I don't think he was injured, so I think he'll be okay for Lombardia.
I think Nibali will be very, very difficult to beat and has, a sort of score to settle after the Worlds last weekend. Just on a related note about Lombardy, there's some interesting just snippets in the Italian press this week about Damiano Cunego, who, of course, is a three-time Lombardy winner. Didn't make the Italian team, was never near it. Very much the forgotten man of Italian cycling, a real mystery to everyone in the Italian cycling community at the moment, and so much so that Lamprey are apparently despairing of him and just do not know what to do with him. He still has a year left on his contract, and there's a possibility that he might not even see that contract out, because they're not happy, he's not happy, has had no results to speak of all year. and really is completely in the wilderness as a rider. So I think he will ride on Saturday, but don't expect great things from him.
So it's a negative tip.
It's a negative tip.
Can we discuss the ongoing controversy at RCS Sport?
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll get your tip first, Lionel.
Oh, I was trying to get out of that.
Yeah, no, let's hear who you think is going to win.
Well, I would say Rui Costa will be right up there because he's won the rainbow jersey.
He's wearing a nice white new jersey.
He's joining the Lamprey team next year on a one-year deal.
A one-year deal.
He backed himself a bit there, didn't he?
Yeah, they offered him 3 years and he wanted one.
And so now he's won the world title. I mean, presumably Lamprey aren't paying over the odds for Rui Costa. I mean, they're not among the big payers, are they?
No. Although,
but they'll push the boat out for him. I mean, he left Movistar because they couldn't afford to keep him, because they improved Quintana's terms, and they've got not a huge budget. So, you'd think he'd be on a million plus.
Yeah, and Lamprey, I mean, in spite of the controversies that he's been involved in, Michele Scarponi is still on quite a big salary at Lamprey, and it looks as though they don't want to renew his contract, certainly not for anything like the amount that they're paying him at the moment. So there could be some spare cash at Lamprey. And Merida, the co-sponsor there, the bike supplier, are very keen to sort of up their involvement and up their investment, and it's becoming less and less an Italian team, more and more a Korean team, in fact.
So there's a sort of, how will that affect the balance of the colour scheme on the, the green and the pink and the purple? It's a mess, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. At least Rui Costa's jersey will look quite nice.
Yeah, I'd imagine he'll go... We were speculating on Sunday, actually, about who would have the most tasteless World Championships kit. I thought if Fabian Cancellara won it, he would go full kitsch. Or Pozzato. Can you imagine Pozzato
as World Champion as well. Here?
Everything. Yeah. Everything.
Maybe a bit before your time, Daniel, because you're still very young. But do you remember Moreno Argentine's World Championship jersey in 1986? He won in 86, and then in 1987 he got it designed by some kind of fashion designer, and the stripes kind of were. They were sort of pastel
faded in. They were faded in. Yeah, they weren't clear. They weren't solid lines.
No. And it was controversial at the time. I remember Eddie Merckx in the Fabulous World of Cycling saying that it was a travesty to play with
bands.
He was right.
Eddie Merckx, who I gather is a big fan of your biography of Eddie Merckx.
Unexpectedly.
This is a late development.
Yeah, he had a fatwa out.
Yeah, Eddie Merckx, who had a fatwa out against Daniel for his excellent book, The Cannibal. Apparently
third hand. So it might not be true. Just another aside on the World Championship and the rainbow jersey and tasteless renditions of the rainbow kit. I seem to remember some Philippe Gilbert sporting some white shorts, but just to say that his year in the rainbow jersey came to a close, and really very, very disappointing, I thought. The way he honoured or didn't really honour his rainbow jersey. And just Gilbert, since moving to BMC, that one World Championship victory at Valkenburg has really been...
The single highlight of
all of his time at BMC. And you know, if I was a Philippe Gilbert fan, I think I'd be very, very disappointed with the way his career has evolved over the past couple of years.
Now, Daniel, tell us about this RCS story that's in the Italian press today.
Not many details yet, but some money has gone missing from RCS Sport, and three of the directors, including the Giro d'Italia director, Michele Acquaroni, have been provisionally suspended. And there's all sorts of confusion and a lot of alarm about Lombardy at the weekend, because obviously this looks very bad. In light of that and the Giro presentation on Sunday, there's even talk that might be disrupted, postponed because of this ongoing uncertainty about RCS.
It's a shame, isn't it? Acquaroni's been a real breath of fresh air. He's a great communicator on social media, but people who are great communicators on social media, perhaps that shouldn't be used as the sole barometer of of people. We've been burned before, but he has been a breath of fresh air. I saw him on Sunday at the World Championships. He looked very relaxed.
Did he have a lovely He always looks very relaxed,
chatting away. But it suggests that perhaps this is something that has just developed over the last few days. Even he didn't look like a man who was about to be suspended from the organisation.
No, I think it's been going on for
over
a week.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we'll watch with interest, see what happens.
We will.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
So, this weekend is the London Bicycle Film Festival, and Richard Moore went to speak to the director of that festival, Laura Fletcher. Richard, just tell us a little bit about what the Bicycle Film Festival actually is.
It's a festival with bicycle films.
That's excellent.
It's in London.
It's in London. It's a very eclectic selection of films, actually. It's not just racing cycling. It's certainly not just professional cycling. So she spoke a little bit about the origins of the festival. It started in New York, as she explains. It is very eclectic. I've been to it before. It's good. There's usually some really innovative filmmaking, and the range is huge. This interview that I did with Laura leads into an interview with Finlay Pretzel, who is running he's got a project on the go to direct a film about David Miller called Being David Miller, based very loosely on his book, but the approach is quite new, quite novel. So here is Laura, and then we hear from Finlay Pretzel. Laura, how long have you been director of the film festival?
I've been running the festival in London since 2008, and I worked on it as a volunteer in 2007, so this is the seventh year I've been working on the festival here in London. So.
And it's part of a global network, isn't it?
It is.
It started in New York?
It did start in New York in 2001. The festival started in New York, and it was only in New York, and then year after year we saw more and more cities asking to bring the festival over to them, and now we're in 25 cities around the world. I luckily only have to deal with the London one, but there is somebody in New York that's been running the festival since day one who oversees every city around the world. So,
were you involved in the New York one as well?
I was not involved in the New York one just when I moved to London here and got involved with it. So.
And it's all happening at the Barbican over this weekend?
Yep, the film screenings are all at the Barbican. They've been our host venue since 2008. Great partnership there. They have some of the best cinemas in London, wonderful film programmers that come in and help us to create unique programming, and are just, yeah, it's a great location, part of the city. So,
do you choose all the films, or do some of them come from New York?
All the films come from New York generally. We do a few screenings in London that will be special films that the Barbican brings in, but generally every year it's free to submit globally, and people send their films in, and then we select the best of them and screen them all over the world.
Where are these films discovered? I mean, who are people making the films for? And is the range from, homemade efforts to quite high budget affairs?
It definitely ranges from people with zero budgets that have just picked up a camera and created a beautiful piece of film just off their own back to, very, very high budget features, that we've seen over the years. And then we like to throw in a few vintage ones sometimes, obviously, the history of cycling film, the Bicycle Thieves and Jorgen Leth films are absolutely legendary, and we like to put some of those in sometimes, and those are the big budget ones.
So what are you looking forward to most this year?
Oh, that's a hard question. We have a program on Sunday, which is called Racing Around the World, which features different films about race cycling, racing bikes from all around the world, and that I'm quite excited about, to sort of see the global perspective on it.
What's your favourite film from all the bicycle film festivals that you've been involved with?
I have got to say probably my favourite film is actually Standing Start, which is a film done by Finlay Pretzel, who's a Scottish director.
Who we're about to hear from a bit later on.
It was done, I think it was a 2008 film, if I'm correct, and it features Craig McLean, who now rides for GB Para Olympics, and it's just a beautiful piece of film which incorporates cycling as its main subject but uses these other sort of artistic forms in it, and it's just beautifully shot, and I swear that one just stuns audiences around the world for every time we screen it. So,
any others that stand out for you?
I don't know, they're all so good, so it's really, really hard to tell.
And the range, I mean, it's
there
a very eclectic range,
isn't
it?
That I really still love to watch, just as like a really interesting piece of film called Riding the Long White Cloud. It was a feature film actually done by 7 US and Canadian skateboarders who went to New Zealand on bikes. None of them had any experience riding bikes, and they rode their bikes all around New Zealand to find the best skate spots. And there was just sort of a beautiful meshing of different sorts of urban cultures in that, and like just blending between the two. And I mean, it was just a perfect example of the personalities that can shine through the struggles that you know, come across for anybody who's picking up a bike from the first time through to being an experienced cyclist. So,
I mean, our main focus on the podcast is professional racing, and there's been an explosion in recent years of books, but there hasn't really been, that hasn't been really been matched in film. There are a few coming out soon. I went to see the Armstrong Lie last week in Florence, and there's a Marco Pantani film coming out, and there are others, I think, in the works, most of them about Lance Armstrong. Why do you think the production of films about professional racing has kind of lagged behind the proliferation of books?
Well, I think as overall there's much more video content coming out about cycling, but there's a very, very strong difference between what we would call video content and what we would call films. These days, you know, there's channels on YouTube dedicated to cycling content, and you know, we're all going out to races creating video content and video interviews every day. And you know, you go to the Tour de France and it's amazing how many video crews there are now, but I think there is a difference in a prohibitive cost about making feature films that you need upwards of, you know, I would say a baseline of, you know, 50 grand to do something that was a decent feature film, and that's probably one of the problems these days. On top of it, access can be hard unless you're, you know, very, very much in there to create something. You know, documentary would be a good place to start, but, you know, as you know, and I'm sure many of us know, it's hard to get access to these guys, especially as more and more media demands are coming around from all sides from them. So hopefully we see some more good films coming out over the next few years. I know I'd love to create something. I would actually love to create something on Bertali and the World War II efforts, which I think is a story that's just waiting to be told by somebody, so...
Is this your pitch for funding here?
Of course, always, yeah.
Good luck with the festival, Laura. Hope it goes well this year, and may it flourish for many more years as well.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
My name's Finlay Brettel, and I'm directing the film called Being David Miller. And it's a film that is trying to capture the actual experience of racing at David Miller's level from his point of view.
His idea to film him throughout a road race?
Pretty much. We're going to focus on a few different races. We've got really good links with the RCS, who organise the Giro d'Italia and Tirreno Adriatico and various other big Italian races. And what we really need is that access to be able to film and shoot the film like we want to shoot it. And it's really capturing the essence of racing at that level, which is the key.
So you've got Garmin Sharp on board, David Miller's obviously on board with it, and RCS. But logistically, I'm thinking the film, I think I'm right in thinking that an inspiration or an idea, that the idea was planted in your head by Zidane, the film that focused on Zinedine Zidane, where the 22 cameras, I think, if I remember correctly, 18. Followed him throughout an entire game, 18. So how do you recreate that in cycling, in a road race?
Well, that's the biggest difficulty, really, because there's so many unknowns and so many different factors. They're travelling from stage to stage, and it's an absolute unknown, and controlling those factors as much as you can, which you have to when you're trying to make films, is the biggest problem. And I think it came from Zidane, which kind of inspired a film I made with Craig McLean called Standing Start.
The track cyclist.
Yeah, which really kind of... What we wanted to do is try and get to the essence of what it feels like to ride on the velodrome, on the boards, which in that sense is so much easier because there's so many controllable factors because of the velodrome, the space, and only, Craig's only riding for maybe 30, 40 seconds. So it was really kind of the build-up to that, and then bang, it happens, and then it's finished. With this, is a much longer process, and we've spent a lot of time researching and trying to...
Am I right in thinking David Miller actually saw that film, and then that's how the approach was made, or that's how the contact came between you?
Yeah, pretty much. I kind of wanted him to see it, because I've wanted to make this film for so long. I wanted him to see it, and by the time I actually saw it, which was maybe... met him, is maybe 3 or 4 days before we actually met, before he actually got the DVD, and he'd watched it 12 or 13 times before we saw each other, and we had this kind of great discussion about what we could eventually do, and that was maybe 5 years ago, so, and we've just been in discussion since. I've made other films, and we've both been doing our own thing, and then just in the last kind of year, I suppose, it's coming together.
And what do you need now? Because next year might be his last year. So the plan is to do it at the Giro. And, I mean, in terms of placing cameras, you presumably have one on a motorbike, you'd have Would you have cameras on other riders, on David himself? Helicopter, how would it work?
All of that, really.
Fixed points.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, to be honest, there's so much that hasn't been done in terms of sound, in terms of really capturing that kind of... You know, when you look at cycling on TV, you don't hear anything. You don't hear the breathing, the chain, the gears changing,
the tires.
Yeah,
the switch
exactly.
Of the tires,
yeah. So I think there's so much more that can be done with that. And I think we're going to try and follow it at various different races. It's a logistical headache, but it's, to be honest, these things, they're only worth doing if it's something that's going to do something different.
So what do you need to make it happen now? Money?
Money, of course. We're kind of trying to raise money via private investment, basically. And you can find out more about that by following the film at David Miller Film, at David Miller Film.
On Twitter.
On Twitter.
I'm sure people can get in touch if they've got loads of money they want to fund the film.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you, Finlay. Good luck.
Thanks very much.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Richard, you mentioned there that while you were in Florence at the World Championships, you had a chance to see the Armstrong Lie. I've not seen it yet. I'm very much looking forward to catching it when I can. But can you give us a bit of a preview of what to expect?
Well, we just heard on the Wednesday night after the time trial in Florence that there was a new cinema opening in town. And they were showing the Armstrong Lie, which certainly hasn't been released widely yet. It was premiered in Toronto and also in Venice, I think. So it had subtitles. Fortunately, it wasn't dubbed. And it was very good. It was very interesting. I've written a review of it on my own website, richardmoore.co. And a lot of people did ask, when will they be able to watch it? And the answer is, I don't know. For me, I enjoy that's helpful.
Thanks, Barry Norman.
I enjoyed it, and I think all of us who went to see it enjoyed it. We found it fascinating and compelling. But one minor gripe that I had was that it did feel like there were sort of two films shoehorned into one. It started out as a film of his comeback, the story of his comeback in 2009, and so that footage forms a sort of basis for the film, but then it became a different film. It became a film about Armstrong's cheating, and so there's this sort of disconnect because the footage shows this diminished Armstrong. He's not the Armstrong of old. He's not the ruthless Armstrong who dominated the tour from 1999 to 2005. And so there's almost a sympathetic figure that we see in 2009. And yet, the story, the more important story that's told is of how he was this ruthless cheat. And so it's strange to reconcile these two figures in a way, because you do see Armstrong in a different light, in an interesting light. You see him as a father. You see him dealing with drug testers and being kind of outraged. The sort of closest you get to a loss of temper is when drug testers from UCI and USADA arrive at the same time. That's quite amusing. So, I mean, it's interesting. Armstrong is, whatever you think of him, and probably not a lot in most cases, he is fascinating, and it's fascinating to watch him. And I personally love the footage from 2009 and the behind-the-scenes stuff in his battle with Alberto Contador that year. And I feel that there's probably a lot more of that on the cutting room floor.
It's really interesting you say that about 2009, because having been at that race from start to finish and seen Armstrong arrive back on the scene expecting the figure from 2005 and still probably in my mind thinking of him as this kind of giant, the rampaging ego and the brashness and the power of him.
And the invincibility.
The invincibility. And actually seeing him not win the time trial in Monaco, and then when he forced that split in the crosswinds, or helped to force that split in the crosswinds to put Contador out the back. And then there was a Twitter exchange, wasn't there, in which he taunted Contador, his teammate, and said, still got a lot to learn.
Yeah, that was actually earlier that year. It was Paris-Nice, wasn't it?
That's right, it was Paris-Nice.
I remember.
But it was gone going all year, and there was this... Yeah.
But at the time, it was kind of, you're right, this sort of... this disconnect between the powerful figure we still assumed him to be and the reality, which was that he wasn't the Lance Armstrong.
He was vulnerable,
yeah.
And you know, that was interesting to see. Now, just moving on from that, don't know if you want to say anything about it, Daniel, but I really wanted to talk about your new book, Mountain Higher, which is a sequel to Mountain High,
yes.
And a prequel to Mountain Highest, yeah. I imagine.
Did you really want to talk about it? Or
I really
did. You feel duty bound?
Well, you did say when we turned up this morning, do you mind if we talk about
my
book? Which we attended the launch of your book last night.
Yeah.
A very successful,
you were very prominent.
Very successful occasion.
Yeah.
So just tell us a little bit about this book, Daniel, because volume one was quite a phenomenon, a publishing phenomenon. Your publishers last night... your publishers last night were telling me that in the glossy hardback coffee table pantheon,
yes.
You were up there with Jamie Oliver and Gwyneth Paltrow. That's what they said.
Yeah, what a dinner party that would be.
Yes.
As long as Jamie's doing the cooking.
Exactly.
Or Gwyneth.
Exactly, microbiotic dinner party.
Anyway, tell us about this book.
Yes, so the first book was about the 50 kind of... they weren't all iconic cycling climbs, but the majority were the Tourmalet, Alpe d'Huez. It was really the sort of every cyclist's bucket list of climbs to do before they die. We really wanted to go off the beaten track a bit with the second book, using very much the same principle. Concentrating really on the mystique of these climbs, not talking about, you know, me riding up them, although I did actually ride up them, but I don't talk about myself at all. It was about the history, it was about the legend, it was about, you know, really the flavour, the landscapes, and born really out of my and Pete, the photographer's, well, particularly my passion for
Pete Goading.
My passion for cycling in the mountains and the exhilaration of riding in the mountains and
the climbs
and just these fabulous natural theatres and you know, the different dimension that gives the cycling term.
Yeah, I mean the text, I should say, you draw a lot on the sort of history of the roads. There's a bit of engineering in there. There's also the history of the sport. You know, a lot of the climbs have some connection. Obviously, the Eau de Quarmont is there and Col d'Ez.
Yeah.
These are climbs that wouldn't probably be in the book if it weren't for bicycle racing. But what is interesting, and it was interesting, your publisher, Tong, last night, how they had a different vision for the book where it would be pictures of cyclists,
yeah,
climbing mountains, and I imagine they also would have wanted the text to reflect the rider's experience of climbing,
yeah,
the mountains. And you took a completely different approach, and the pictures are all empty but very inviting roads, and as you say, you don't feature, and I think that would have been a very different and, dare I say it, lesser book.
I think it's all the better for that, because everybody has their own experience of these climbs. I've read Mountain High, enjoyed it very much. So far in Mountain Higher, the first one I turned to was the Eau de Quarmont in Belgium, because I've ridden that climb countless times. It's one of the key climbs in Het Volk, Het Nieuwsblad, the one-day race. It's in the Tour of Flanders. There's a real sort of sense of kind of agricultural atmosphere around the whole area. And I know what I feel about it, and I'm not necessarily interested in knowing what somebody else feels about riding these climbs. You could have fallen into that trap of making it into a sort of travelogue type book, which wouldn't have had quite the same sort of it's the sort of the level of detail and the understanding of the areas that I've been and cycled that I've gained from reading the book.
It does make me want to go and ride some of the others. Yeah, there's a cracking book, Mountains of the Mind, by Robert McFarlane, which is a history of a fascination, is the subtitle, and it's about man's relationship to man. And I would say that those would be very complementary, those books. You know, your book as applied to cycling, his as applied to mountaineering.
Yeah, and you know, just as regards the selection of the climbs, so there are climbs like the Eau de Quarmont, which are very well known, but we, you know, sought to tell different stories and show a different side to those climbs. Like in the Eau de Quarmont, we talk about the village halfway up the Eau de Quarmont, which is, you know, this climb features annually in very famous races, but no one knows anything about the village halfway up, and it's quite a famous village in its own right. It's an artist's community. And other stories about other well-known climbs, like the Col d'Ez, stories from the 14th century about the Ayres, the town at the top, being sacked and you know, a revolution taking place there. But those were the already very well known climbs, but we hope to tell a different story. And then there were also climbs which really no one has ever heard of, but by virtue of the incredible landscape, by virtue of stories to do with cycling or to do with military history, engineering history, are very, very significant. And also extreme climbs was another area that we wanted to explore, that it's becoming more and more fashionable for professional races to go higher, harder, and there's a community of amateur cyclists who, you know, they're adrenaline junkies. They have almost turned it into an extreme sport. They're looking to sort of raise the bar ever, ever higher. And yeah, there's a decent portion of climbs which are just monstrously difficult.
Tell us about the mystery climb in Italy that you went looking for, and you weren't sure if it even existed.
Well, there was a climb, the Rifugio Calvanico, that was spoken about a lot in Italy a few years ago, which was billed as the Zonkolan of the South, and there was lots of speculation about this being included in the Giro d'Italia, and the various newspapers picked this up, and there was a lot of hype about it, and there was Angelo Zomignan, the Giro director at the time, appearing on, I remember, a video message where at the end of the 2010 race, where he talks about a mystery climb that was going to be coming in 2011, and on the back of that, there were feverish posts and reports on message boards saying it's going to be the Rifugio Calvanico. Anyway, Pete and I, by this time, I think we'd already started the process of writing this book, and I decided that this climb was going to be included. But the more I researched it, the more I investigated, the more confusion there was about what this climb actually was, where it was exactly, and which road it was. And we went down there to Calvanico, which is a small, kind of grubby, nondescript village outside Salerno, and no one in the village knew about any road that fitted that even vaguely this description of the Zonkolan in the South. Basically, we spent about 3 or 4 hours there talking to people, and I'd done a lot of research as well, and we finally found this road, which was the Zonkolan in the South, the Rifugio Calvanico climb. But the notion of it ever appearing in the Giro d'Italia was absolutely preposterous, because it was a tiny, crumbling road that was perfectly rideable on a road bike, and extremely steep, but not as steep as people had said. There was talk of it being 13% for 15 kilometres. It was nothing like that. But this was the climb that people have been talking about. But it just ends, peters out in a forest about 1,100 metres above sea level. An absolutely fantastic, spectacular climb, but it will never feature in the Giro d'Italia.
Unless they knock down the forest, presumably.
Well, exactly, exactly.
Is it in the book, though?
It's in the book.
It's in the book. In all good bookshops now?
Yeah.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
It's been a very commercial podcast. Yeah, we've all been plugging things. That's not a trend or anything, I think. Apart from when the anthology comes out, eh?
Mm.
Anyway, finally, final part. Let's just talk again about John Tiernan Locke, the ongoing case of him being asked to explain some alleged anomalies in his biological passport. We talked about this on Sunday, Lionel, but you weren't obviously there. It was your newspaper, the Sunday Times, that broke this story.
Well, not my newspaper, but a newspaper that I sometimes contribute to, yeah.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that.
That's putting Richard back in his box.
And,
nice. Yeah. No, I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Right. Right.
No.
It's not my newspaper, but it's a newspaper I contribute to. I did a little bit of work on Jonathan Tiernan Locke's background for the paper on over the weekend. Yeah. Mm.
Richard, if you want to host this podcast, what are your facts for
it? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, the biological passport is much misunderstood, isn't it? I think everybody, when they heard that this relates to values recorded at the back end of last year, automatically thinks this is ridiculous. How come this has taken a year to come out? But the biological passport is it establishes patterns, doesn't it? And if the UCI has reason to suspect that values are outside of the normal parameters, they write to riders to ask them to explain those values. My first thought was that it's not a great precedent if this information leaks out like this. ahead of the rider having an opportunity to explain themselves. And so, you know, it's difficult not to look at the whole thing in the context of last week, the presidential election. There are so many little strands to this that are interesting to explore, but obviously, you know, we have to be a little bit careful about exploring them. But, you know, Pat McQuaid's son, Andrew McQuaid's company, Trinity Sports Management, represents Jonathan Tiernan Locke. Jonathan Tiernan Locke rides for Team Sky. Brian Cookson was running against Pat McQuaid in the UCI presidential election. There's an awful lot of sort of interests involved in this one case that maybe not connected to the situation directly, but it does make it make for a fascinating kind of intriguing
landscape. I mean, what one landscape. One sort of misunderstanding that has that frustrated me a little bit this week is that he has been treated as though he's failed a drugs test,
yeah,
and he hasn't. And, you know, There may be a perfectly reasonable explanation, legitimate explanation for these fluctuations in his blood values. It is not the same as failing an analytical drug test.
Absolutely
he is not. He is not now having to explain why a banned substance is in his body, and you know that distinction has been lost a little bit. Certainly, in some of the more mainstream reports, shall we say.
Yeah.
It just underlines as well the very precarious nature of cycling sponsorships, sponsoring a cycling team. Look at the millions and millions that Sky have invested, and you know theirs is a global project. They want to make cycling more appealing to families and, you know, a very wide audience. And something like this, and the press coverage of this could potentially jeopardise a lot of that. And you can look at other things which can be picked up by the media, particularly the British media is not that au fait with some of the intricacies of anti-doping and how it works yet. And for example, I know of riders, a lot of riders who've had missed dope tests, who are on two strikes for reasons that are purely innocent, you know, that they've forgotten to update their whereabouts, etc., etc. But that is a similar thing, that could be picked up by a mainstream newspaper and they could say, you know, a team has this rider who's willfully dodging dope tests, and that then reflects incredibly badly on the sponsor and the team. And you do have to be responsible in the way that you interpret this and the way you report this.
I think it's very unfortunate that the story has been leaked, and there is a lot of interest and intrigue around the source of the leak, which we probably won't find out. Certainly David Walsh, who broke the story, will not reveal his sources, quite rightly so. My instinct, though, tells me that it could be the source could be the UCI or somebody at the UCI. There's a lot of speculation over the source, and I'll tell you what, I think we can rule out anybody at Team Sky or British Cycling.
But do you know what else? Also, people in cycling are very indiscreet.
It could just be
purely Jonathan Tiernan Locke mentioned it to someone who promised not to tell anyone, and someone couldn't keep their mouth shut.
I do understand that Jonathan Tiernan Locke has known about this for 2 weeks now. So it was a week before he told British Cycling, I understand. That might not be true, but that's what I've been told.
Going back to the biological passport, the unfortunate development in the last couple of years has been that this has gone from being a tool that the authorities can use to spot anomalies and act upon them in the first instance privately, and then a panel of experts are then supposed to decide whether there is a case to answer. And there's a very clear idea of how this should work. And if we're going to get into a situation where stuff is getting leaked, then it completely defeats the object.
It's a little bit like TUEs, I think. I mean, a precedent was set at the Tour this year that Chris Froome was asked about TUEs. I don't think riders should have to, I don't think any athlete should have to declare all TUEs. But there may be circumstances where there are good reasons for them not to want to declare TUEs. The rest of us don't have to declare our medical history, even to our employers, do we?
Very true.
I think the Tiernan Locke, just on a similar note, the Tiernan Locke case might also highlight another weakness in the biological passport, in the sense that this is a system which tracks someone's physiological parameters over time. And it takes about a year, it seems to have taken a year in this case for the UCI to have built a profile. However, let's posit that Tiernan Locke was doping last year and stopped doping, or a rider was doping a year ago and stopped doping. Now, if the UCI wanted to use the biological passport
as a tool on which to base target testing, it's taken them a year to build that profile and to identify the anomaly, by which time the rider might have stopped doping. Mm. So the target testing, it becomes useless.
The target testing becomes useless.
But Anne Ripper's point was, what is the point of anti-doping? The point of anti-doping policy is to stop people doping. So if the biological passport and target testing makes a rider who was doping before stop doping, then it has achieved its goal. And I think that that was kind of one of the points that was missed when Anne Grippo left the UCI, was that that was a huge loss, because she believed in anti-doping as a philosophy, not just a set of rules that have to be adhered to. And I think the UCI has lost a lot in the last 2 to 3 years, that a lot of good work had been done. The idea of scaring people straight and having a cleaner and hopefully clean sport.
Yeah. Anti-doping as a deterrent rather than a punitive.
Absolutely. And we should point out, you know, Jonathan Tiernan Locke's, any anomalies could be down to a number of factors, could be illness, you know, and you're absolutely right, Richard. We're kind of getting a glimpse into some quite personal information, some personal, you know, people will keep wanting some kind of explanation to be in the public domain for this, when really it should have all been done behind closed doors. And if there was a case to answer, then open that case and get on with it. And if there isn't, then...
Somebody told me this week that roughly 1 in 4 of these cases end up in some kind of doping charge. So for every doping case there's been with the biological passport, which I think is only about 8 or 9, in fact fewer than that, because some of those were target testing from information on the biological passport, but there are 4 times as many riders who've actually been in a similar position to Jonathan Tiernan-Locke, asked to explain anomalies in their blood values. We're being surrounded by school children here. It might be time to... We will return to this story, but what something you mentioned earlier, Daniel, about the precariousness of supporting a team. I mean, I've spoken to Dave Brailsford and others involved in Team Sky in the whole gestation of the team in the early years, where they've said a single doping scandal would end the team. That could be what's at stake here, I think. And perhaps this will be there'll be reasons to, if this does go all the way to a doping charge, then there may be a way of for Team Sky to wash their hands of it. We just don't know. We're speculating, but the stakes are very, very high. I think they're nodding. You can't hear that on the podcast.
Yeah, but. I mean, I think. If I was Dave Brailsford, I'd be straight on the phone to Gianni Savio, who is the master of the press release. My friend Gianni Savio, the master of the press release, making it very clear that the doping offence, well, alleged, took place when the rider was at.
I mean, he must have a standard letter that he just presses send, does he?
Yeah, I think Gianni, to be fair, Gianni has been quite unlucky with this. He has had a fair few riders who have been.
You saw him at the weekend, didn't you? Very dapper.
He was looking very dapper.
In the rain.
Yeah, I always greet him as my favourite. Gianni Savio is an ardent Torino fan, and Juventus are Torino's arch rivals, and always greet him as my favourite Juventus fan, just to wind him up. He's about the only thing that can wind Gianni Savio up. He's the most unflappable gentleman, I think, in cycling.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that, fellas. Lionel, thank you. Daniel, thank you.
We'll be back
next week.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.